Have you dreamt about taking a float plane into a remote wilderness to fish where you are the only person for miles? Would you like to know some of the key tips on planning this dream vacation? And if you had to pick between bull trout, rainbows, grayling, pike, or walleye, which would you choose? We're heading back into the Northern Rockies today with Daniel from NR Adventures. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where we show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fishing since I was a kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about any show in the world. Today, Daniel from NR Adventures is going to describe the best times of the year to catch bull trout, grayling, and some of these other big species in their area. And you're also going to get the three biggest questions you should ask when getting started on planning a big trip this year. Plus, you're going to find out how a pro NHL hockey player set up an ice hockey pickup game in the middle of the Alcan Highway. Daniel's going to take us there today. And if the Northern Rockies aren't on your bucket list yet, we might be changing that today. Here we go. Daniel from nradventures.com. How's it going today, Daniel?
Doing excellent as always. Counting down the days to fishing season now.
That's right. Yeah, we're in. I love the recap because we're doing a summer. We'll put a link to the show notes to the first big episode we did with you where we talked with your dad, which is amazing. I always feel like the connection with the family is pretty amazing. So we had that. We'll put that in the show notes. But also it's show season right now, right? So you're fired up. You're kind of doing that. And it's kind of February, right? Going into March. How long until you actually are flying that plane and taking clients around?
Well, I mean, the nuance there is taking clients around because we're already starting our training for the season here.
Oh, wow.
So we're getting everything ready. The plane's finished our annual maintenances in December. So we've started a lot of training on each of the aircraft. We fly four different airplanes. So it's quite a bit of work to get everyone trained and dotting the I's and the T's, due diligence. So we are flying already.
Amazing. Amazing. So you're going. And how was the overall, how's it been going up there? Snowpack, are you guys getting, sounds like there's plenty of snow, or how was it this year?
You know, it's a little bit of a tough one. I think there's areas that have a regular snow amount. With such, with our region being massive, but there's also right where our lodge is, we had we have plus temperatures and we're melting snow again. So it's been a bit of an odd winter. I'm going to be interested to see. I think it'll lead to a shorter spring runoff, but overall, it looks like there's less snow than there was the previous year.
Okay. Sound like from some of the people down more in the, not the Northern Rockies, but down in kind of the U.S. Rockies that they're, yeah, it was late, but now they're getting a bunch of snow. At least, they're catching up. But cool. So we have that. So, and we'll link out to that episode so people can get the full depth on kind of where you guys are at. But give us the high level. Where are you located kind of in relation to the U.S.?
Yeah. So, we're in northern British Columbia, Canada. So if, just putting BC on the map, it's on the west coast. So just north of Seattle is Vancouver, and we operate all our trips out of Vancouver, BC. Our fishing area is right north, all the way at the top of the province at the Yukon border. There's a massive protected area up there called the Musquequechica, and it's 6.2 million hectares of protected virgin land, ideal fishing, and we fly into that with our float planes on a daily basis.
Perfect. Yeah, so essentially, we're heading up into a remote part of the country. What's the closest town near where you guys are at?
Well, the closest town to us is actually probably Watson Lake, which is just in the Yukon. But some kind of landmarks people might be familiar with is, of course, the Rockies, the Rocky Mountain Trench, which kind of divides the two mountain chains that we fish, the Rockies on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side, the Cassiar Mountains, the Spitzizi, which is to the south of us, which we fish the top of, and the headwaters of the Skeena that we also fish. So those are kind of sort of known quantities in the fly fishing world, but we're that big area that really has been very untouched and unexplored, and I think we're all the better for it. We all know the best fishing spots are the secret ones.
Right. Yeah. And we've got a couple of secret spots. We've talked about this a lot in the podcast. We're heading down to Brian Niska's place on the Lower Skeena. I'm not sure how many hundreds or thousands of miles that is from you, but essentially you guys are in the headwaters and we're going to be catching a steelhead down, kind of way down below you. But so that's kind of puts us in perspective where you're at. We're going to build out kind of what a trip looks like for somebody, but maybe give us another kind of high level when people are coming in up to basically go fishing with you guys. Like, what are the main reasons? Like, what are the main things that are getting people up to your neck of the woods?
You know, I think the big draw for fly fishermen is definitely our rainbows. You know, a rainbow is a known quantity. It is very much a staple of fly fishing, and we get beautiful rainbows up there. And you know, you mentioned you're fishing for steelhead in the kind of the, not the tailwaters, but the lower down the reaches of the region we are. So our rainbows, there's definitely something with them. They get pretty big. You know, we get 20-inch plus rainbows up there as well. So yeah, the rainbows are very sought after in our area. And also the Arctic grayling, which is a little bit interesting because usually you don't have the rainbows and the graylings in the same region. But since we separate going either to the Pacific or the Arctic watersheds on our trips, we fish both, we're able to tap into those kind of diverse kind of fly fishing species. I think, you know, the grayling is one of those fish that maybe some people haven't had the opportunity to fish for, but it's a total thrill for a fly fisherman. Like, the grayling is the most willing fish to take a fly, be it on the surface or even a nymph. They're very, very cooperative to fly fishing, I'll put it at that.
That's amazing. Well, I just talked to a listener yesterday who was kind of going back and forth in email, and he said he's got this goal to catch all of the trout species in basically North America. And I was like, wow, that's amazing, you know. But so that's something up here. There's a few trout species, and I guess Arctic grayling, you kind of put them into the same category.
Yeah. So interestingly, it's not uncommon for people to put them in with trout, but they're actually totally unrelated. So yes, they're very avid to take a fly, but they actually are in a bit of a whitefish family. So they are very separate, but they do behave very much like a surface feeding trout. And with that big sail fin there, they actually have a lot more power than most trout when they do take that fly. Yeah, we have three different species of trout. So the rainbow I mentioned, the bull trout, which is BC's very, very known for the bull trout at this stage. And then we also have really big lake trout up here. So three species of trout. We kind of round the fly fishing off with the northern pike, which are a lot of fun to catch on a fly rod. And then we also have walleye in the mix too. So yeah, six trophy species leaves not much to be desired in fishing potential. And you can hit all of those species in a trip, or you can kind of cherry pick the prime seasons for each of them.
Perfect. And the rainbows, so I think we might have touched on this before, but the connection to the Skeena. So is there any connection from down into the Skeena Basin, or is there like natural waterfalls, things like that?
Exactly. So there's natural waterfalls, but there is direct kind of connections. I think the steelhead just don't wander all the way up into our region because it is fairly far north for them. But there's definitely been some mingling of the populations there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And that makes sense. So I'm just kind of guessing here, but I think, you know, maybe that, right, it's probably have a similar life history, or maybe there might even be overlap or some of those fish.
There's probably some overlap, I would say. It could be that maybe there was some sort of disconnect somewhere, or the rainbows don't wander as far, or the steelhead don't go as far up, but those species can definitely hybridize, and it might be one of the explanations for some of the larger ones we get. There's a couple regions, the closer we get to this, you know, where they do pretty well.
Gotcha. So no, I'm starting to think about, you know, how a trip would be here. And I could see doing something like that where you fish the Skeena for steelhead and then head out to your place for some, you know, to hit the upper watershed. But what is, you know, let's talk about like if we were putting together a trip. So right now, let's just say we had some people that were excited to head out there. Where do you start with that? What's the first, what do you think would be a great time to set up a trip to go out there?
So, you know, my fly fishing season usually starts in mid-July. I say usually, and I'll go into the nuance of that after, but usually in mid-July, because that's where the dry fly fishing, the rivers are running really clear. We get really nice mayfly and caddis hatches. That's really the core of when the fly fishing is most active and predominant, all the way up until roughly the third week in August. And it's really good fly fishing in those periods, mainly for rainbow trout, bull trout, Arctic grayling. And then luckily the pike are really good then too on the streamer. So you get a lot of variety, but you may have noticed that I kind of dropped two species out of there, and that's going to be the walleye and the lake trout. The walleye can be caught pretty easily on conventional gear that time of the year, but to be spin casting for a lake trout or fly fishing for a lake trout in July or August, unless it's very cold water feeding into a lake, it's not going to really happen. Those species, they're very sensitive to water temperature. That time of the year, they're going to be deep. So if one were to want to catch all six species are in our region, well, then we would have to look at June. We'd be doing a little bit more still water. At the end of June, there's a nice kind of pocket week there where the water actually runs clearer, and you can do pretty good on the rivers and the streams then too. So for all six, there's a narrow window. For the best fly fishing, it's actually for midsummer.
Midsummer, yeah. Okay. So if we were to say go out there the first week of August, that would be a decent time to go out there and have some good action.
That's a very good week. I find it's nice and buffered by either end of the season, right? You kind of know what you're getting with that one.
Okay. So first week of August, and then what does that look like typically for people coming up there? Are they doing shorter trips, staying for a week? How does that look?
Yeah, so we're fairly up there, so it's a bit of a journey. So we do a week-long trip, and then we really switch it up by the number of flyouts that guests do. So what's kind of unique to what we do is we're a fly-in fishing lodge, but we're not fly-in to the lodge and fishing really at the lodge very much. What we really specialize in, what my kind of father built, is fly-in fishing on a daily basis. So we fly to the backcountry, we fish for the day, and we fly back to the lodge in the evening. So I like to say it's the best of both worlds. You have the comfort of the lodge resort, and then you have, this fantastic backcountry fishing, and it's really phenomenal. So that's what we specialize in. We have two packages, either doing four flyouts or six. So doing six, you're flying out every single day, and doing four, you're flying out, well, that's roughly 70% of the time, and you can fish at the lodge. There's beautiful hot springs to explore. There's a lot to do if you're not flying out as well too. But I think between the two of those, it kind of covers all bases.
And when do people typically, do you have a set time they typically arrive?
Yeah, so it's always on. The trips are always Sunday to Sunday. However, we do have requests for custom trips, and we do those. We have a very kind of exclusive kind of fishing weeks. We do a maximum of 8 guests a week, but we do sometimes have guests who would like to arrive at different dates. Operating our own airplanes, doing the flight out of Vancouver, we are able to do that. It is definitely different from the standardized pricing, though. It is a bit more premium to show up whenever. So Sunday to Sunday works really well. It allows us to not overlap groups. It also generally allows for pretty good travel connections with people arriving in Vancouver on Saturday, flying up with us on Sunday, and then we get them back to Vancouver roughly by midday so they can actually travel back for Sunday. And, they're only really booked out of 1 work week like that.
One week. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And then when we say, let's just pick a week, say it's August 4th, you're flying it. So basically you're at the airport. Now, how does that work? Yeah. We talked about that. We won't go deep into that, but you're going to fly us up to the lodge. Once we're at the lodge on Sunday, let's just say you're flying out the next day. Is that kind of how it works? The next day you fly out first thing in the morning to a
Exactly. Yeah. So basically you arrive up at the lodge. We get everything set up. If you're bringing your own gear, great. Otherwise, we set you up with our gear. So we definitely can provide that. You meet the guides. We have a nice dinner. We already start the conversation. Before you've booked, you've probably let us know what species you're looking for. But with the intel from the last week, we can really hone in and say, hey, you know what? I think we might want to start off this week with either some rainbows or some grayling, which is pretty standard for us. I like to start the week with a really, we have so many different fisheries. I like to start with a quantity of fish. So I like to go in the beginning for smaller rainbows. We have a spot where, 60 to 100 rainbows per angler is not uncommon, pretty frequent. And like that, it gets everyone a little bit set up for the trip. Like they're getting used to hook setting again. They figure out kind of what flies work. It's a really fun first day. The grayling are like that too. You can sit on a grayling spot and easily get into those numbers, 60 to 100 of them as well. And it just gets everyone warmed up. And then the next day, we'll start, customizing it. Do we want to go go kind of for the trophy fish, or do we want to start chasing the maybe more exotic pike or whatnot? But we do that on a daily basis, so we can really kind of dial in. If people said, "Hey, you know what? I love just getting fish after fish after fish. You got another spot like that?" And of course we do. And then we can make day two something like that, or we can, you know, change it all up. But it's really that freedom of that float plane to be able to do that.
That's the cool thing about it is that it's totally flexible. So you can have a day out there and catch a bunch of rainbows and grayling and then say, well, maybe we'll take another day and do something else, go for another species. And it sounds like it's pretty flexible. And then I think Brandon Morrison, when he was out there, is that one of those places where I think they were catching a bunch? Is that kind of that first spot that they were at that they really had a great day?
Yeah, he hit a number of spots. So he hit one spot for like 2 hours, and I think he was talking about that. And yeah, he hit it for 2 hours, and I think he was saying he caught like 30, 40 rainbows in those hours, and his buddy did the same. And there's quite a few spots that are like that. And then he had another one he went to for rainbows. He's catching really nice rainbows, but once they get bigger, there's usually less of them in the area. So, you know, that was his 20 fish day, but they're his average size. It was way up, right? They're your starting at 14, 16-inch rainbows and going up.
Yeah. And are these mostly fishing kind of in streams that are flowing into the lakes, or are you fishing the lake as well?
So generally we fish in the streams or the rivers. The rivers up here are more like streams down south because they're very headwaters. So yeah, it's mainly that. Sometimes if you're really trying to get onto a pod of fish, generally the inlet is where it's at. So if you're going for 100 fish a day, probably the best spot to capture is the inlet or the outlet, either of which, depending on where the fish are that day, can be incredibly productive.
Perfect. And what's the, so, and again, we'll put a link to the Brandon Morrison episode. He's a professional hockey player. He was a professional hockey player. And I think he talked about it. One of the quotes he had, well, there's a video out there. I think he's done a couple of YouTube kind of shows with your program. And I think he said it was like the greatest place. I can't remember the exact quote, but he had a great time up there. Do you remember that trip pretty well when Brandon hit up there?
Oh yeah, of course. It was quite the memory to have him up there. I wasn't part of the impromptu hockey game on the Alaska Highway, but they set up some nets after a day's fishing, and they're
Oh, did they
playing
really?
hockey like kids on the highway. And I don't know,
Oh, that's amazing.
it's pretty cool. We still have a photo of them, him, you know, in his whole hockey garb as he played for Vancouver Canucks in the fishing lounge. It's yeah, it was a lot of fun fishing with him. And I think he had a lot of fun too, because he came back a couple of times, and he's
Yeah.
pretty eager to be back up there. And we just need to see if the stars align, right?
That, exactly. So you're saying that they went, there's a highway that goes next to your lodge that they literally like just they put right on the middle of the highway and started playing hockey.
Yeah, and you know, when I say highway, it's titled it is the Alcan, the Alaska Highway. However, when we say highway, we can probably use that term pretty loosely. It's not like an interstate. It's more like a road that on occasion has someone travel through on. So yeah, they definitely took advantage of that extra bit of pavement there, and did their own little hockey game.
Good. Okay, so we got a couple of good show notes links out there, and the hockey thing is funny. I think I'll definitely ask Brandon about that next time I talk to him.
Yeah, I can send some photos over it.
I'd love that. I'd love that. We'll put those in the show notes as well. So if we're talking about, you know, again, this trip, so let's take it back. So Monday, let's just say that first day we're flying out to one of these places that has lots of rainbow. After that, you know, you come back to the lodge, right? And you're getting prepared. What could a day two look like?
So the follow-up act is really, really open to, you know, guest preference there. But usually we will go into more kind of trophy fish, maybe the more exotic pike, or even chasing, for example, the bull trout, which the bull trout and the pike are predominantly streamer fish. They will eat on the surface, and when they do, it's incredible. But you generally 70% of them you catch on the subsurface, and it's a little bit more of a nuanced thing. So that's why we like to get people warmed up for that. Or we'll go for big rainbows where the quantity of fish goes down to probably, you know, 20 or 30 caught, but the average size goes way up, you know, 14 inch plus.
That's it. I think that would be an awesome next day is, I mean, even one of those species, I think I could see like, okay, let's just focus on bull trout and go for a bull trout because I think a lot of people haven't caught a bull trout.
It's one to check off, right? It's a little bit like the grayling too. Like a lot of people haven't caught them, and they're sort of interested. And I can say that, you know, with confidence, once they catch one grayling, they're going to catch many and they're going to love every single one. And the bull trout is like that as well. It's a totally different type of fish. It's a predator, very pescatarian, loves to feed on rainbows and grayling. So you're going to catch either of those species when you're catching the bull trout alongside, but the bull trout, you're going to know when you have one on the line.
Yeah. And are you catching those bull trout in the same areas where you're like the smaller streams, or is this more out in the lake?
So you know what? The bull trout is very interesting. Their bull trout seems in our region, and I've talked to a couple kind of biologists about it, the bull trout can almost get higher up into the alpine than any of the other species. So even I think it'll even outclimb the grayling. So I have some spots that are exclusively bull trout where they've kind of turned into their own little ecosystem, you know, from prey bull trout all the way up to the big ones that predate on them. So there are streams, rivers, lakes, they're in all of them. In some areas, the bull trout, they're very similar to Dolly Varden. They're kind of interlinked, just as a steelhead is a little bit to a rainbow. In some areas, the bull trout wander through. So I target them generally in August. We talked a little bit about July and August being the fly fishing months. If the bull trout is the target species, I would lean a little bit more into mid-August because it does open up more of a window, and especially for those big ones that like to. They probably wander all the way into the Stikine or the Skeena doing their feeding, and then they come back. Yeah.
Got you. So maybe August, maybe more like a August 11th or even 18th might be better if you're really wanting to get those bull trout.
It can be, right? So I think, you know, I think we're already going into that slope of it. It's the seasons of when we catch the fish are really determined on the fish species that, you know, our guests are looking for. So I always say to people, hey, you know, this isn't one of those buy now trips. I don't really believe in that kind of mold. It's send me an email. Let me know what you're looking for. Let me know how you want to catch your fish. Maybe you're a beginner fly fisherman and you sometimes will use a spin casting rod, or maybe you have friends that just want to predominantly spin cast, or you just want your truest, you want to catch everything on a fly rod, you want to catch everything on a dry, you know, you name it, I'll find the week for it. We have a very very intense kind of summer kind of season for fishing, starting in June all the way up to mid-September. And from week to week there is quite some change, and there's some weeks that are similar to others, but on average within a 2 week window the season can change quite a bit.
Yeah. What is, when you look at your area, maybe describe it a little bit and how it compares, because there's a lot of, you know, there's lodges all over British Columbia up there. Like, how do you say, what separates you from maybe some other lodges that are out there?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what separates us first, most of the lodges in BC are way, way, way to the south. They're down, you know, along, you know, maybe like Kootenay, Columbia River. Some of them are in the Prince George area. A lot of them are along the coast. You know, they're salmon fishing. That's kind of it for BC's lodges. Like, it's very salmon dominant and very much kind of to the south of BC. We're way, way north of all of that. So what that means is we're fishing areas that no one else has access to. There's no bumping into another guide up here. We've been here for 40 odd years, been a family business. You know, we have these secret spots, and you know, I'll sometimes mention to some guests and I'll say, hey, you know what, we're flying into this spot. I'll give you the name, but we're not putting a pin mark on it, please.
You're not using your trout routes, right?
No, this is the trout route guys. We talked about the trade show season. They're like, oh yeah, we'll get you on trout routes, and I'm like, no, we're good. we're really good. I don't need to. But you know, the other thing is, even if these spots, you know, leak out, we're all of, you know, our secret fishing spots are, we are way north. It takes, you know, getting a float plane all the way to northern Canada or flying it all the way in from Juneau, it is quite the gauntlet. We're actually parallel with Juneau. That's the elevate, that is the latitude that we're at. So we're up there. So it's not the easiest thing to set up a lodge up there either.
Right. Gotcha. So that's it. You're remote. So if you want to fish and see the Northern Rockies, I mean, obviously it's in your name. I mean, you are the place that can take, you know, there's not many other places you're ever going to get this chance. Like, you are the Northern Rockies.
For fishing, we're at the core of it. That's why we put it in the name. And the adventures comes from, you know, all the other things we do. You know, we've been doing this for 40 odd years. My father really, you know, dial in all these fishing spots, but me and my brother and my family, we've grown up in the area too. So We with the adventures, we kind of pay homage to all the other things, activities from the hiking to the hot springs to the mountain biking, which is, a dual passion of mine. I have been known to go biking and fish, and so it's a pretty cool place. It has so much to explore. There's still fishing spots that I'm testing out. Me and, Dad sometimes at the end of the season will sketch out on a napkin some other spots we think are doing good, or we'll look around over the summer and I'll go set up camp and check those spots out.
What type of bike do you have? I'm curious because I've got a mountain bike, but I'm weak.
I have a Norco, a good old Canadian mountain bike, Norco Sight. I'm pretty happy with it. I put a lot of suspension onto it though, just to get a little bit more flotation over all the jumble and give me a little bit more of a cushion when I land. When I land with the rubber side down.
Exactly. Yeah. Are there and up in this, are there trails and is this like there are jumps and a whole trail network up there where you're at?
No, it's very different. So it's a lot of horse trails. So there, this region before, we kind of got the fishing going, and still there's a lot of guide outfitters that did hunting in the area, and there still are. And so there's a lot of horse trails that are actually really fun to ride on a bike. There's some backcountry, roads. There's some high alpine trails that I've kind of picked and choose some paths through. But no, it's nothing like a bike park with jumps or anything. It's if you're jumping it's probably off, some little gravel shelf or a lip or between tree roots. But it's still nice to have that suspension.
Gotcha. So somebody could, if they had like want to do like a family thing or something like that, bring the family up and do some hiking, do some fishing, and do some. I mean, really, a lot, and this hot springs you said. What else is could we add to that list as far as kind of the outdoor activities?
Oh yeah, we can really expand that. So obviously we have our own bikes up there too, because that's a little bit of a hard one to bring along. We have ATVs up there, so we can do like little ATV day trips. I really love to take people out canoeing. From the lodge, we have some beautiful spots, for either we can canoe the lake, but there's really also a couple nice simple kind of rivers to run. They're, 6 maximum 6 hour journeys. Some of them are 4, so we can do that as well. We also do a wildlife viewing. There's, being in this massive protected area, the Musquecachica, there's an abundance of wildlife. So there's a lot of people that'll come up. They'll do, these 4 days of fishing, and then maybe they want to do some wildlife viewing, check out those hot springs, and you can kind of combine those two interests very easily, or even a hike all in the same kind of day 5 of your fishing trip, and see something totally different too, which is pretty cool. In the fall, we get into the Northern Lights, and actually in the winter, we do a full-on Northern Lights tour. We combine it with New Year's Eve being one of the darkest days of the year. It coincidentally is one of the best to see the Northern Lights, and so we do this Northern Lights tour then. But we get Northern Lights from August on, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You got to wait till the fall. So you get the Northern Lights. And then right now it's kind of, February time, right? What's it like now as far as light and are you still seeing Northern Lights there now?
Oh yeah, it's probably we get a good Northern Lights display about twice a week, 3 times a week. So you're seeing them very frequently right now. So it is a really good time for them, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's just switch this up a little bit now. We've been talking kind of July, August, but if we're talking September, and say you want to catch the Northern Lights, maybe the start of them. You're still fishing in September?
Yeah, catch the Northern Lights and catch some fish. Yeah, I have quite a few people that do that too. And you know what? The fishing actually only gets better as the fall progresses. The issue for me is usually from mid-September, it gets pretty windy. We get really strong winds. So where we would say, you can do 6 or 4 flyouts, I just cap it off and I say, no, we do a maximum of 4 flyouts. And sometimes at the end of September, I might say, okay, we're doing 3, because it just, you can get out there, but it's just going to be bumpy. It's not really a very enjoyable for a flight. And then on top of it, once you get into like these mountain lakes and the rivers, the howling wind, even on a river protected by trees on either side, you're going to get, the ripples. The fish don't like the weather change either. It's something, you can really tell when there's a low pressure system, which is leading to probably a lot of wind. The fish are going to be deeper. They might, go from the rivers into the lakes that are nearby, or they might, just sit hunker down in a deep pool and be really uninterested. So we fish up until the middle of September because that's pretty consistent fishing. And then after that, I'll do a custom trip here and there, but it does get more technical.
Yeah, I see. So there could be, and you would see Northern Lights potentially in that early part of September?
Yep. Yeah, I see them pretty well. We even see them in August, but it's really September is where you can start seeing them pretty, you know, consistently as opposed to sporadically.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're building this out. So I want to dig more into kind of some more this timing in the species, but I want to touch base on the float plane really quick on that. So describe that a little bit. You guys have these giant float planes. What's that like landing or taking off in a float plane? Just describe that a little bit. How does it compare to, say, just in a normal, like, you know, whatever other airplane?
Yeah, so we started off with a Beaver and a 185. And over the years, Dad, he loves airplanes and, you know, kind of upgraded here, upgraded there. And now we're sitting on a pretty sweet float plane fleet of a Turbine Otter, which is up to a 14-passenger airplane. But we only fly 9 people on it, 8 fishing guests and the guy and, you know, an extra guide or so, Dad being another guide. And then we have this Cessna Caravan, which is on amphibs, and it's set up with 7 passengers. So both being turbine powered, they have a lot of power. What the takeoff kind of looks like, it doesn't matter if it's a 185 or a Beaver or, you know, a big turbine or Otter or Caravan, it's different. First of all, you turn on the engine, and the airplane's already moving.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's a little thinking thing for pilots, but it's also for, you know, guests. It's like, oh, you know, why aren't we stopped and doing our engine run-up check and that? It's like, no, you're doing that while you're moving. Because
oh, wow.
On floats, you know, you don't have any brakes. Once you're untied at the dock, you're floating. And even the lightest amount of thrust you can have, the propellers all the way to feather, it will generally suck the airplane forward with just the momentum. So that's the first little thing that changes up. Then, of course, you're taxiing and you're kind of setting up for a takeoff. And now once you get into the takeoff, we, you know, apply power as you would on a runway. Once again, we don't do it from a brake. You're just slowly accelerating and then, you know, we apply power. Now, you know, it's go time and you can really feel like the water kind of rushing underneath the floats. And then it's just like a speedboat. We get it on step. So we actually kind of push the nose down a little bit and we get this. It's actually a balancing act. So if you're kind of flying it, you're kind of balancing it on the step. You don't want to pull too far back. The heel of the float will dig in and it'll actually drop off the step. And no matter, you know, some aircraft, you're not going to lift them off like that. Most of them you won't. So you have to get it back onto the step. You go too far forward, you can slip off the step forward, and that's actually something that, you know, critically you're watching out for as well too. So it's a balancing point. And then that's not even enough always to lift off. Generally, we do a little wiggle of the wings. So we lift one float and then we lift the other float and then we depart. So it kind of looking out the window, you see, it's like looking out, you see one heck of a wake, and then all of a sudden you'll kind of feel one float is out of the water and then the other one, and then we climb out. So yeah, the float plane is very different, and on landing it's the same thing. If you have really nice smooth water, or sometimes even the choppy water, you'll have an amazingly smooth landing. It feels less like you feel less sometimes on a water landing than you ever do on wheels. Depending on the waves, you can also feel, you know, a little bit more. But it's amazing. Sometimes wavy water is less bumpy than what we call glassy water.
I see. Wow, this is cool. No, I love that you're painting this picture, because I always think, like, I mean, the takeoff from a plane, I guess some people maybe don't enjoy it, maybe do. I kind of like just that feeling of, you know, you're blasting off on a plane. Do you fly also just normal airline, kind of airline jets, sort of? Do you do that often?
On an airliner, I don't fly an airliner myself. I fly, you know, float planes and bush planes, and we have our King Air that we fly, which is kind of close to an airliner, and that's a very different takeoff as well. But yeah, I always, you know, it doesn't matter what airplane I'm in or helicopter, I love to take off. I think it's such a little miracle of machinery that we're able to, you know, kiss the bounds of the earth and lift off into the skies, right? It gets me every time.
What does that feel like for you, Daniel? I mean, do you feel like you're a pilot? Does it feel like you're just sometimes, again, back to that pinching yourself, do you feel like, wow, I'm flying planes? Is that pretty amazing?
Yeah, I really love it. It's I think for me it's always a freedom, you know. It's different when you're flying around and you're going A to B like an airline pilot. But you know what me and Dad are doing here in the Rockies, like I mean, if we didn't have guests fishing with us, I probably still would be flying to all these places and fishing myself because it's a dream, right? So we love to do this, yeah.
That's great. Have you, what do you think about getting in? Could you jump in a 747 and fly that thing if you had to?
I think once I figure out, the engine controls and the instruments, I think I would do maybe a half, like an airplane's an airplane. Like if it's the smallest little Cessna all the way up to a big jet, but you do need to, there's a lot more gauges on those things. So if I was given the time to figure out where all the switches are, play some flight simulator, I think I could take off. I think anyone can take off a plane. It's actually pretty simple. Float planes being a little exception.
Well, I always think of when we're on a plane, I'm thinking, well, even the landing of these giant jets, I think it's all computerized for the most part. You know, I mean, that's kind of on auto. Is your stuff on autopilot quite a bit, or do you doing everything? What happens when it's super foggy and you can't see anything? How are you landing or taking off?
Well, you're not flying a float plane in those conditions.
So have you ever had to be in a situation where you landed where it was really foggy?
So I'm instrument rated. I've never flown the float plane where it's, foggy because we call it like we're not in, some sort of life-saving flight system, so we don't have to
Yeah, the
go out
Coast
in those
Guard or whatever.
positions. Yeah. So we're not taking off if it's even looking remotely like it could be a hassle. But I also fly instrument ratings, so that's kind of what the airliners do, and that's what we fly for King Air. So I have flown, total whiteout conditions and in those airplanes that are set up for that, and it's a different feeling. Yeah, you get spatial disorientation, so your body will be telling you that you're turning, but actually you're flying dead straight. It's the acceleration in your inner eardrum that'll kind of sometimes fool you, and you really have to trust your instruments. So that's why I say, when you're flying in those conditions, the plane that's set up for it, you never want to be in an airplane that isn't, because there's too much inaccuracy in the instrumentation to allow for that. And there's prescribed altitudes and all sorts of, it's a different type of flying. It's very bureaucratic, it's very procedure based.
Sure. The landing is all. I mean, that's the thing. I'm always feeling like, okay, we're in the air. You're getting some of the rocky stuff, at least in the big jets, the airliners, and then coming down for the landing, I'm always thinking like, well, yeah, this is all computerized. I'm trusting the computer, but yeah, it is kind of what you're thinking.
I don't want to burst a bubble there, but it usually is not.
Oh, it's not.
Nope. Generally, they say that so I just heard this statistic recently. Like I talked to a lot of airline guys. We have actually quite a few airline guys that fly for us on our King Air because it's pretty much a small airliner. And they say that actually there's a statistic out there that the most automated airplanes in the airline industry are the Airbuses, I think. They're pretty much up there. And they say for an Airbus, doesn't matter how long of a flight, if it's an 8 hour flight or a 2 hour flight or an hour flight, doesn't matter. The pilot flies for a minute and a half. And that minute and a half is takeoff, autopilot on once they're airborne, landing, coming in for landing, right down to 200 feet. So like 10, 20 seconds before touchdown, autopilot off, landing. They can land on autopilot. I think some of the really advanced systems allow that, but generally we actually find that people still land better than computers, which I, it's kind of my job security here. I'm taking over from my dad, and I'm
Right.
hoping that still continues to be the case. It's weird, computers with AI and all these things,
I know.
they're
I
incredibly
know.
intelligent, but
They're not
there's a
perfect.
feel to flying an airplane. Yeah. And the perfection gets you. Like aviation, you obviously don't want to be making mistakes as a pilot, but there is such a thing as being too perfect, which leads to being kind of jerky. Like when you're tuning an autopilot for an airplane, the tendency for the autopilot is to always maintain its heading no matter what. And when they're setting them up, sometimes these things are so aggressive with their corrections that it's totally uncomfortable. You kind of want, this lizard brain, thousands of millions of years of flying an airplane or you know, a human still has, you know, we have a buffer where we have a place in the cockpit still is what I'm getting at.
Exactly. And I'm getting to the car too. And I think about the car, the lane control, you can do that too. Your car can drive itself now with lane control. But the problem is that the lane control doesn't work. Maybe some cars, but I've found it doesn't work that great. It's really herky jerky, the same thing where like jerks you back and where, you know, you don't want that, obviously. So
exactly.
No, yeah. I think we're good. I think AI is still a little off from doing the full like robot flying the plane, you know, that's still ways off. But
so we're gonna be driving our cars and we're gonna be flying our airplanes for a number of years to come, and I don't mind that.
Me neither. This is good. Okay, so let's get back on the trip. So we're back to so we're talking Monday, Tuesday, you know, and then looking at Wednesday. So we talked a little rainbow, a little bull trout. What could that next day, if you wanted to? I mean, I guess if you had great fishing for either of those first, you might keep doing that for day three.
you could make that. You could like with
the whole trip.
Yeah, well, so I can customize, you know, from rainbows to bull trout, like each of those species have about a good dozen spots we can hit. So you're not going to the same spot to get the same species. You're going to have different experience each time. So
each time.
But what I like to say, let's say we started off with rainbows. We got a couple bull trout. Why don't we go take a look at some grayling? I think that that's a species that maybe people haven't checked off their list yet. So let's go check those out. And what's nice about them is they're generally... they're either going to be right at an inlet, or what I love is to go get them in a mountain stream. So they love these big pools, and that's where the big grayling usually hang out in the summer, in August. They're going to be up the river system, up in a pool, and they're going to be way up there at the mouth of a stream. And that's what I would do for day three, because I love to catch them in that environment. And once again, there's a couple spots that we can, you know, a variety of spots we can pick out for that, but that's, I think, is always really impressive to be up in the alpine, you know, catching these beautiful fish.
Yep. So grayling's another one. And then as you come back again, let's just say that there's three flyouts right there. So your third one, you come back on Wednesday, you sit down, I know you guys have the epic meals there because you have your own cuisine, and I think you're even have some chef skills, right?
Yeah. So I've actually worked 10 years in the fine dining industry. I trained as a chef in Europe. So I will generally once in the week there make a dinner as well, and you know, I helped the culinary team. We work together on all the menus, but they sometimes, you know, we'll do a catch of the day as well too, which I like to do because I love catching fish, I love cooking fish, and I love eating fish. So generally, you know, maybe the grayling is the one that we want to put to the pan. It's an interesting species to eat. Its name is actually Timaeus. I need to quickly look up the Latin name, but thyme, because it has a thyme flavor to it.
Oh, thyme, right.
So Timaeus arcticus. Oh, my Latin's terrible, but
gotcha. Yeah.
They have a sweet taste to them. They're just a total delicacy to enjoy.
Yeah. Are they kind of bony? Are they kind of lots of bones, or are they not kind of like a trout?
They're just like a trout. So I think that's why a lot of people see them as a trout. They bite like a trout. They fight better, I find, than a trout. And they're, you know, their fillets are like a trout, but they're very different. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to have a nice meal, or you have some of your, I think last time you mentioned some of your meals from like your home where you guys were from originally, right? You serve some of that too as well.
Yeah. So we, you know, I kind of even skipped that. On day one, generally we open up with our traditional schnitzel and spätzle.
Oh yeah.
So that's a breaded pork cutlet, with spätzle being a pasta. It's a homemade pasta we make, and we use my mother's recipe. So it's kind of like a welcome to the lodge. Of course, we, you know, dietary wise, do all sorts of different things. You know, we customize and we tailor this. With 8 guests a week, it's a very custom experience, you know, from start to finish. But usually the intro to our cuisine is actually, you know, this is food from our home country. And then we build the menu, you know, based off the guest wishes from there. And I think it always works out really well. By the end of the week, we've ate and dined around the world. My wife is from Mexico, so we sometimes have a little bit of that flair sneak in an appy or a main as well too. So yeah.
Wow. You got the Mexico. That's my favorite food pretty much. So good. And then if we stick around the lodge, let's just say for that next Thursday, you're going to stick around so people can just hang tight, maybe not do a flyout and do what, take a canoe out, or what would they do if they, or maybe do some of the other stuff we talked about, biking or something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, that's totally an option, right? And I think that's sometimes not a bad thing to do, because you fish now 3 days back to back. These are, you know, these are 8-hour fishing days. And, you know, with the catch rates that we have, like pulling in easily 30 to 50 fish a day, if not more. And you know, even a diehard fisherman, that's can be a little bit tiring too. So I would go maybe check out those hot springs. Like that's it'll really relax, you know, that casting arm. There's a beautiful little waterfall right at the hot springs. And if you're, you know, if you're diehard like me, you're gonna want to sneak in a little bit of fishing. And you know what? Of course, I have a spot along the way. So what's nice is we don't just send people out on canoes. If you want to do that, you know, by all means. But we have a guide at the lodge that will do that. So usually my mother does a lot of the guiding at the lodge. So, you know, hiking or whatnot, or even going to the hot springs, it's pretty nice to have her along. She'll, you know, drive you there. But she also is very well versed in all kind of the flora and fauna of the region. So, you know, wildlife viewing along the way, you'll probably see some bison, and then, you know, we might see some moose as well too. And then as we get to the hot springs, it's a really interesting spot. Being on the Continental Divide, of course, we have a lot of fissures and hot springs kind of creeping up. And these hot springs, the Liard hot springs that we're at, are truly incredible. They have orchids all the way up in northern Canada, and there's a lot of, you know, there's ferns, there's just things we don't see anywhere else that far north, but they're there because of this geothermal activity. So, you know, to have her along, it she's a dictionary and of plant and wildlife, and it's pretty cool to do that. And if we're out canoeing, it's the same thing. You know, we like to, you know, speak of the local history and you know what makes this area unique. Because we all, you know, we grew up in this area and we live here, but we think the most important part is to share this knowledge with people, is that hey, there still is an untapped, untouched region of the world. And you know, we want to keep it like this. I think untapped is the right way to put it. We want to keep it untapped. We don't want, you know, all of a sudden a bunch of mining. And if we can create a connection over the wildlife, the nature up there, I think, you know, we all take that back home in our hearts. And I think it's really important to us. It's more than just the fishing, right? The fishing lives and dies off of that as well though
It
too.
does. Well, I was just thinking about like our conservation shout out, and but you mentioned the mining. So is there a potential for any of that up there? Do you hear like people maybe talking about doing that?
I think there was a heavy talk of that in the 90s, and that's when, you know, a lot of operators, and we kind of supported this Musqueam Chica coming in. It is a wilderness protected area. So there is interest of mining, but it has made the requirements for them substantially higher, but it does has not fully blocked it. So it's always a little bit of a threat. I think right now it is something that is threatening the, I believe, the Stikine. So it is, you know, outside of our area, it's very prevalent. I think our saving grace is our mountains. They act as kind of a wall, and they make everything a little bit more costly and difficult. So fortunately, our, you know, we've been pretty protected.
Yeah, good. Well, let's go down that to just kind of that conservation shout out for a sec here. So, you know, this is obviously presented by Northern Rockies Adventures here, but what do you think is there a group or anybody around there? Or maybe you mentioned that one, the Stikine or whatever, where somebody can learn more?
Well, the Musqueam Chica is the core of our conservation area. It's unfortunately not very well funded, but if people just look up the Musqueam Chica, spelled Muskwa, and then Kachika is Kechika, they'll see first of all how massive this area is, but it'll also come to a website titled Musqueam-Chica.com, and they'll learn all about the conservation area.
Well,
And
good.
yeah, we're very active with that too. We work with
Sweet.
quite a few people on that level, and
There you
it's
go.
yeah.
There you go. No, this is great. So let's take it out here. So that's the good kickoff. I love that you have a great group to follow up with there. So let's take it out. We're just finishing up this trip. So we talked about the hot springs on kind of Thursday. So Friday, Saturday, let's round this trip out. What will we be finishing up? What are the say we got one more fly out and then one more hang. Would this be a pike trip potentially?
I would think, you know, if it looks like the theme of what we've done here is we've hit every species, you know, that's in its prime in August. So may as well finish with a bang with a big pike fish.
It is. So August is good for pike too.
Oh yeah, that's I think one of the best times for them because they're in the weed beds. You can get them earlier in the season. You can catch them in June fairly well, but they're generally not going to be as large since they're just kind of coming from the winter and their spawn, so they're going to be a little bit thinner. So August is the time for the big ones to be hanging out in the weed bed. So you can sight fish them really nice. So I would say Friday I would go pike fishing, and we're gonna, you know, now we're gonna be a lot more still water. We're gonna have a boat. We're gonna kind of set up or anchor up or even wind drift a bit, and we're gonna cast for these pikes in the shallows and the weed beds. And it's generally 4 to 6 feet of water is kind of the max, and you're gonna be sight fishing them. So you're gonna see these, you know, pike anywhere from 14 inches, which is tiny little pike for our standards, all the way up to, you know, 40 inches hitting a streamer, that 40 plus inches actually following streamers in to the boat. And the cool thing about it is you don't really have to relocate much, just kind of like what Phil does. You know, you set up anchor, or you wind drift, the fish will sort of come to you. They're all just sitting, they're ambush predators, they're sitting in those weed beds. You cast, kind of go kind of like an hour, like a clock, you know, cast 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and man, working your way through that, you're gonna find pike in places you didn't even see them there until they hit. It's pretty neat.
Nice. This is cool. So my thoughts were that would kind of take us to Friday potentially, and then Saturday, well, of course we'd celebrate Friday, I'm sure, with some beverages maybe. Is that a potential there?
Oh yes. Yeah, there's definitely some potential. And I think Friday is also, that is probably one of the harder days of fishing, with the, you know, fighting these bigger fish on 8 and 10 weights. You know, you're gonna be a bit sore. So maybe it's good to celebrate with some beverages and take it easy. If you're really diehard, you can always add a day of flying fishing, maybe chase rainbows one more time there on the sixth day. But you know what? It's for a lot of people, this might be a nice time to relax one more time. We can do some fishing from the lodge. I can take some people to a different little spot there too, and then we can kind of tie up the week like that.
Yeah. And the one thing we didn't cover, which we could have added to this, is I think the little fly out to the cabins, right, you guys have there. So we talked about that in the last one, which is pretty cool. But yeah, that's another opportunity.
Yeah, so we can do a combo trip. Yeah, exactly. So you can fly into one of those cabins, spend a couple days there, and then do a couple flyouts after. And you know, you've been there, you've been fishing 6 days, you know, back to back to back to back. But that's another way to do it. So there's a lot of customization. There's what's pretty cool about our trip as well, and I get this a lot at the trade shows, is, well, you know, my husband doesn't fish and I do, or vice versa. I just want to break the stereotype there. And there's so much for, you know, someone who's not fishing as well. There's a whole week's worth of activities or more for that. With the fishing, at the end of that week, I hate to say it, it's one of those trips where you look at it and you're like, man, I don't know. I just want to be back, because you're scratching the surface of it, right? We're kind of cherry picking the spots.
Yeah, you could spend like any place we talked about, you could spend 6 days just doing that. I mean, I could see us fishing bull trout for the whole time, or pike for the whole, you know, or the hot springs the whole time. Do that every day,
Yeah,
right? You could do that.
there's, and you know, there's other places in the world where you're kind of tied to two or three fishing spots, and that's what it is. And you know, you take the boat and you float the river again, right? And you could totally make, you know, your expert class on your favorite fishing spot up there and have great fishing throughout. These spots, they see about 40 odd anglers maximum a year, because we
A
do
season.
rotate a season. Yeah,
Right.
well, a year for us, because they freeze up pretty quick. But it really spreads out really good. So yeah, you could spend every day at a spot if you wanted to, and you know, you'd find more nuance to it than probably even my father and myself. We've hit them over many years and many seasons, but generally we look at a different spot each day. It's kind of funner like that, right?
Yeah, no, I hear you. So give us a couple things before we get out of here. I guess first one is, let's take it down, like takeaways from today. So we've been talking here about a lot. What would be your, say, three takeaways out of everything we talked about today? Somebody's sitting here thinking about, wow, this would be an amazing trip. What do you leave them with that is kind of a reminder of what we covered today?
You know, I think, you know, doesn't matter if you're doing a trip with us or anyone else. I always think the questions you ask when you're planning a trip like this determine the trip. And in our example, if you tell me, hey, I want to dry fly fish, it's going to help me a lot in getting you to the right fishing week. If you tell me you want to catch, yeah, and the species, and then you say, hey, I really want to get bull trout. Well, we talked about that changes, you know, end of July week to a mid-August week, because that's just going to be better for that species. So I think having that conversation earlier, you know, availability is always a thing with these with kind of fishing lodges. Us as well, we take 8 guests a week, and we have about 14, 16 fishing weeks. It does fill up. So to have those conversations, to have those questions, that'll really help dial it in. Then travel arrangements, that's actually a thing that I think our lodges probably we excel at. Really easy. That's always one of those questions, I think. We take it from Vancouver. So that means we pick you up there, we bring you back, makes it really easy to plan. But that's something you always need to think of when you do a trip. How do I get there? What's that look like with connections? You know, some places are way more remote, and you know, it's important to plan the travel arrangement, and that's why we take care of that. Yeah.
Exactly. Get there early, get there maybe a day early so you don't have to worry about your bags. I've heard that one before, and maybe paying for the travel insurance when you're coming up just in case something happens. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've had that happen where the bag gets lost and somebody's sitting there without a bag, right?
We had a lot more of that before we did our own flight. You know, coming in with the international airlines, they're pretty good. The major airports, they're fairly on top of it. You know, I knock on wood. But the one where we notice a lot of lost bags, it's always those little regional carriers. Not to throw any shade on them, but it's just, you know, small airplanes, quick transfers. They do a milk run. They often stop at multiple airports before they come to your destination, and they're unloading, they're loading. You know, it happens pretty quick that the wrong bag gets unloaded, and there you go. So that's why one of the many reasons that we do our flight in-house. It makes for an easy connection. It also means the things arrive.
Yeah. So you literally have your own, essentially your own airline.
Yeah, we have our own little airline that we run out of Vancouver, and it really
That's
makes for convenient flying.
a few hours. What's the flight from Vancouver up to your place?
It's pretty fast. It's 2.25 hours is the flight, and then we pick our guests up at the airport and drive to the lodge. We can't land right at the lodge. You know, kind of airline style airplanes don't do very well on lakes.
Yeah. Gotcha. So 2 hours while you're on that plane, do you get some snacks like you would on your Alaska Air flight or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. We have a little some
Some
snacks and everything.
schnitzel.
Yeah, sometimes there's a schnitzel sandwich too.
There you
But
go. That's it. Nice. Awesome, Daniel. Good. Well, and my last one for you today is we've been talking about obviously your lodge, which is amazing. What would be a bucket list place around the world that you'd like to travel to? Maybe a species. Have you thought about that? Like if you go anywhere in the world, like easily, what would that be?
if I could pick anywhere, you know, I don't even know much about the fishing. I love the biodiversity of Peru.
Oh, Peru.
I've been looking at Peru for ages. There's a really cool restaurant there called Central. I think he's pushing the culinary world, like eat one plate at a time. It's amazing what he's doing there. I would love to go to Peru. Of course, I'd love to fish there a little bit. But from what I understand, I just want to see the nature. I love these untapped kind of places, and Peru definitely has its industry, and it's not very great at times, but I think to there's still some beautiful nature there, and I want to see it. There's a lot of verticality in Peru, and I love mountains, so that's where I want to go.
Perfect. I love that you said Peru. That's one we haven't talked a lot about, so I think I'll have to look up. That's the cool thing about it, right? There's literally a species in every country, every place in the world now that you could kind of fish for.
Yeah, and I think, you know, fishing wise, I don't think I'll be disappointed. I think it'll be, you know, mountain rivers, I'll feel pretty at home.
That's right. Yeah, it's just like here. It's cool. All right, Daniel. Well, we will send everybody out to nradventures.com if they want to get more information and check in with you on, you know, setting up their own trip, you know, and I think this has been awesome today. I think we've shed more light on this part of the world, Northern Rockies, and it sounds spectacular. And I know I'm gonna have to re-listen to the one with your dad because I just love his accent and his passion for it too. So we'll re-listen to that episode. But yeah, thanks again for all your time, Daniel. We'll be in touch.
Yes, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and you know, we'll keep those lines wet and keep on fishing.
There it is. If you get a chance, head over to nradventures.com right now and check in with Daniel. Let him know you heard about this podcast today. And if you get a chance, if you want to check out all of our schools and trips coming up, you can go to wetflyswing.com/schools right now and see what we have new on the list. I'm going to get out of here. We got a bunch to do, including some more intros and outros and more episodes and fun stuff this year. Check in with me, Dave, at wetflyswing.com. If you have any feedback for this podcast, and I want to thank you for stopping by the podcast today, and I hope you have a great afternoon. great evening or great morning, wherever in the world you are. And I look forward to catching up with you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.